It's showtime.
Bob Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Had the God reverb on there for some reason. And here we go. We are off and running, and it is the 28th day of June 2018. There's this broadcast and one more, and then June is done, and summer is a third done, more or less, and we will get started on July. Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It is Thursday, Thorn in the Side Thursday, I might add, and this is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us. That's also a good place to go, the only place to go, if you'd like to participate in the merry, madcap, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is The Horn chat room. Pick yourself out a screen name and a password. Jump right in. You will be immediately greeted by the likes of Anatole and Man Cave and BT Blom, and moderated by yours truly, unless Man Cave decides to fold space and et cetera, et cetera. But he's working in the Man Cave with his... with his minion, I read a couple of minutes ago. Let's see. We are running downhill toward finishing fundraising for the month of June. I despise talking about it. I was hoping that we would have had 5 whole days of fundraising free radio, but it didn't quite work out that way. Still hoping for one day of fundraising free radio. Thank you very kindly to Catherine and another... anonymous contributor. We had $180 to go to finish up. And now we have $50 to go to finish the month of June and qualify for the Trash Fits Walker Stand Challenge, courtesy of Ralph's, which will then also, Ralph said she'll also kick in an extra $25, which is awesome. So that's where we stand. We've got $50 in fundraising to go, and then we can have fundraising free last broadcast of June 2018. Okay? We have thanks to send out, of course. We always have thanks to send out for our subscribers, the Set It and Forget It crew. Yes. That would be... our buddy Smitty in Florida. Thank you, Smitty. And thanks to Charlene in Rhode Island. And thanks very kindly to Philip in Texas. Thanks very kindly as well to Sharon. Thank you, Sharon. Thank you very much indeed to our buddy Harold, President and CEO of Sochtris, the Secret Open Carry Happy Trails Roundup Society. Thank you, Harold. And thanks as well to our buddy Randy in PA, long time subscription supporter of The Horn. Thank you, Randy. Thank you one and all, because that's how we keep the program on the air. I had some news from Kathy. I filled in for Malloy these last 3 nights. Mike is back home, and Mike is raring to go. So Mike will be He's going tonight. None of this lollygagging, laying about, being sick for Malloy. That ain't how Malloy rolls. So there will be brand new, fresh, live, real Malloy programming, featuring, of course, the one and only indefatigable Mike Malloy this evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Yay! Welcome home, Mike. And in turn, this will be, for the first time this week, a full three-hour program. I'm looking forward to that. Hopefully that means we'll have folks jumping in to engage in conversation. It would be mighty fine if people did. Let's see. I need to do one thing real quick. Sorry, these things just happen, but now I've got to restart the Skype machine, but that doesn't really have any impact on anybody at the moment. So anyway, five people at $10 a piece. Hey, how about five brand new subscribers at $10 a piece? Over at headon.live, click on PayPal, click the little button that says make this happen the same way every month, and away you go. But we've got $50 to finish the month of June, and that one, and what an awesome thing that will be. Okay, it's Thorn in the Side Thursday, and I confess that I loathe, because it's just so damn difficult to talk about, because eventually you run out of things to sort of say, and it feels a little like a broken record. I loathe it when program time comes around and we've had another day of the NRA's roulette wheel of death. Today, the NRA's roulette wheel of death stopped on Annapolis, Maryland. And today, five more people earned the Wayne LaPierre National Rifle Association Natural Manure Medal of Freedom, you know, for being innocent victims of gun violence that the NRA has no interest in helping us to prevent. Before we get started, though, courtesy of Ron and Raleigh, today's Star Trek reference, obligatory. Today marks the passing of the writer of the best Star Trek episode, City on the Edge of Forever, Harlan Ellison, at the age of 84. He was also the writer of the best episode of The Outer Limits, The Man with the Glass Hand. He was also the author of something, was he not, called Callahan's Crosstime Saloon. A collection of stories that I remember reading many, 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 many years ago that was wonderfully engaging. He was a brilliant writer, and he's passed away. He has gone through the gate at the City on the Edge of Forever. Harlan Ellison. Scott also noting the same. And also reminding us he's the author of A Boy and His Dog. Yes. And an inquiry before we get into the heart of the program this evening. An inquiry coming from our buddy Steve in New York. Subject line, I'm not sure I sent this. I know I wrote this, but I can't remember if I sent this. I heard someone allude to this on the Stephanie Miller show. The person said they thought that these child kidnappings were to have an essentially slave labor force. However, something even worse occurred to me. Do you think I'm crazy to think that this is a policy to obtain free labor for the silly, well, I would say stupid, but silly wall in order to effectively make Mexico pay for it? Well, it'll be a while before those kids are old enough to, well, I don't know, considering the Republican view of child labor, maybe they're not. Five years old? Here's a brick. Carry it, kid. Push this wheelbarrow. Carry that hod. Tote that barge. Lift that bale. because I mean I don't know that that's necessarily the future, but I can say this much. Given the Supreme Court that we're probably about to have, I would not like the chances of any sort of claim against the 13th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States with that bunch. Well, I mean, it's not involuntary servitude. They came to the United States border voluntarily, so we put them into servitude, so it's voluntary, right? Yeah, of course. Okay, correction coming in. No. It was Spider Robinson who wrote Callahan's Crosstime Saloon. Thank you, Ralphs. Thank you for letting me know. Harlan Ellison, still a genius and a titan of science fiction in his own right. Okay. It all runs together after a while. The brain cells get a little muddled. But before we go to an analysis of the roulette wheel of death, let's at least take a moment, shall we, to praise and to appreciate the courage and the determination of a group of Americans in the D.C. area who marched all the way from the Department of Justice up Capitol Hill to the Hart Senate Office Building today, and who then entered the Hart Senate Office Building and sat down upon arrival in the Hart Senate Office Building in quite a multitude. They began to chant, "We care, we care, we care." Now, this was, of course, intolerable to Chinless Mitch McConnell, who immediately dropped the dime to the Capitol Police. And they arrived and gave the traditional three warnings prior to arresting the protesters, most of them women. Once the third warning was given, the Capitol Police began wading into the crowd as the protesters sat awaiting their arrest. That's when things got interesting. CNN was on the scene. There were Senate staffers ringing the balconies, and offering moral support. Those would probably be young Democratic Senate staffers. The protesters said, chanted, "We care," in response to Melanoma Trump, the only First Lady of the United States ever to accept money in exchange for removing her clothing to be viewed by strangers naked. One senator, Mazie Hirono, a Democrat from Hawaii, came downstairs and spoke with some of the women. And she apparently took photographs with several of them. She also hugged them, and as of current reporting, she is the only Democrat that had the courage to stand with the women protesting the ongoing crime against humanity that's taking place under the fascist gaze of the Trump regime at the border. Horrifying that it is. But as they prepared to arrest the protesters, well, let's go to the clip from CNN, shall we?
Where these protests are happening with Congress, I see police have arrived, Sunland.
That's right, Anna. I'll show you the scene behind me. The police have arrived. They just announced to this rather large group of protesters that this is, in their words, an unwelcome protest, and they will be arrested if they do not move out. Now, you see you have a whole fleet of Capitol Hill police officers waiting. And on the other side over here, we're going to swivel the camera here, the protesters.
So that was the third and final warning. Sounds a little bit like the bullhorn voice on Pink Floyd's The Wall, doesn't it? But I love the Orwellian language. It was an unwelcome protest. Since when does power ever welcome protest? Anybody? Because I'm kind of stymied where that's concerned. Of course it was an unwelcome protest. Why the Hart Senate office building, which I've been in more times than I can count, the Hart Senate office building is there so that lobbyists can have easy access to the senators that they buy and sell like pork bellies. And when you got a bunch of women objecting to crimes against humanity, well, it's unwelcome for the lobbyists who have to snake, and I use the word deliberately, among the protesters to get to the elevators, to get up to the offices, to do their trading in legislators. Because remember, and it's worth remembering in light of the announced retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy, it was Justice Anthony Kennedy in the Citizens United decision who said, just because somebody gives money to a politician, and that politician then turns around and does exactly what the person who gave the money wanted them to do, just because that happens doesn't give a rise to the appearance of impropriety or the appearance of bribery or no, heavens no. It's Kennedy said it was just a very, very wild coinkydink that people give money to politicians and the politicians then do the things that the people who gave them money wanted them to do. There's no relationship to buying and selling of votes or anything like that, and shame on us for thinking that it does. In a way, that reasoning presaged what happened a week or so ago, or within the last week, when Sammy Bad Breath Alito on the court declared that white people in legislatures are entitled to a presumption of innocence when they gerrymander congressional districts and legislative districts so as to dilute the votes of wrong coloreds that they wish wouldn't try to vote in the first place. Yes, indeedy. That Anthony Kennedy, quite the liberal jurist. Not. But yes, it was an unwelcome protest. And you know who else was unwelcome? CNN was unwelcome. Ah, very good. Very well, very well said, Arnold. Arnold pointing out that a welcome protest would be a tiki torch parade of white nationalists suffering from a profound case of economic anxiety. Yes, yes, Arnold, absolutely. And you get a cowbell. Mm-hmm. So let's check back in with what happened this afternoon at the Hart Senate office building.
So I want to show you here the view over here, Anna. As you see, many women, crowd chanting, many wearing shirts that say no camp. They do not want these detention camps. They're holding up their hands. Certainly it is a tense scene down here. And I should note that this is a working office building within.
Oh, well, yes, it's a working office building. She also neglected to note that many of the women were carrying signs that said abolish ICE. which would be a fine, fine thing. Because at this point in time, ICE serves no other purpose than the targeted harassment of people who are largely defenseless. They're a bully force. And somewhere in fairly recent modern history, we've seen other examples of such bully forces. What was the secret police in Iran under the Shah sitting there on his peacock throne, Reza Pahlavi? I always remember the name of the Iranian secret police because it's Spock's dad's name, the Savik. Mm-hmm. Another obligatory Star Trek reference for the evening. Yes.
The Capitol complex. This is the building where a lot of U.S. senators have their offices. And we look up in here in the building, you see a lot of Capitol Hill staffers overlooking this protest that's taking place in their building now. You have people lined up, and here we have now what we anticipated. These protesters are going to sit down. They say they are going to let the scene play out right now.
So we're hearing them say, you need to leave unless you're going to be arrested or unless you want to be arrested.
Yes, they're saying you need to leave. A lot of women I talked to said that they would be okay being arrested and that they certainly anticipated that.
You see, are they the kicking you out as well?
They are kicking press out right now. And as you see behind me, the protesters have...
Yeah, of course, you wouldn't want the Fourth Estate there watching the peaceful protesters be arrested. You wouldn't want that at all. That's disturbing. It's not every day that we actually get to see journalists doing journalism, and when they try to do spot coverage of something like this, lo and behold, there's the police, the Capitol Hill police in this case, under the command of, in this instance, since it's a Senate office building, chinless Mitch McConnell, demanding that there be no witnesses to whatever it is that they're about to do. Because this is, after all, an unwelcome protest. Mm-hmm. Under the rubric of unwelcome protest, Terrace notes, a welcome protest would be, we're not racist, but strong borders make a strong country. Yes. True. So let's just check in with a little bit more of the audio, see what happened.
World cellophane blankets on the floor, of course, a reference to...
Yeah, the women, by way of making it clear what they were about, said that they covered themselves in the Mylar blankies that the little infants of tender years are given to cover themselves up in the concentration camps.
Have unfurled cellophane blankets on the floor, of course, a reference to the kids and the images that we've seen in the custody. So certainly trying to make that dynamic play out. Now we are being kicked out right now. We will continue to shoot what we can here.
Sunlin, I know you're trying to kind of get your bearings there, but let me ask you, you mentioned this is inside the Hart Senate building. A lot of senators' offices are there. So technically, is that considered public or private space?
This is public space, Anna. You can get in without a Capitol Hill pass. You have to go through magnetometers to get in, and certainly we watched as one by one these protesters did come in through magnetometers. This is public space where people can go and walk in to the lobby and certainly go to the senator's office and talk to members of the staff. I want to show you a wide shot.
Or in this case, go to senators, Republican senators' offices and be completely ignored. Yes. Because Republican senators don't much care about crimes against humanity these days.
Right now, of this building. It's an atrium of the Hart Senate office building. I think this image here that you have many protesters down on the floor, sitting down, and then you have members of offices, Capitol Hill staff, looking out of their windows, stopping work, looking at this moment that's playing out. And I can tell you from my vantage point here, I do see some arrests starting to take place. We see one woman right here. She is being escorted out by the Capitol Hill police. We see probably about 50 Capitol Hill police lined up. Nothing seems out of the ordinary right now. People seem to be...
What are they chanting, Sunny? Can you hear?
Politely escorted out. Trying to listen here. We do have some random chants over there as people are being escorted out as they're being arrested. I should tell you, it seems very orderly, though.
And it usually is. I mean, because despite what the various and sundry members of the White Wing and the booger eater media will say, these people are peaceful, and they are engaging in one of the single most precious civil rights that exists in this country, the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, even when the government thinks that their petitioning is unwelcome. Right. I get that. Terrace says the broadcast sounds like commentary at the Rose Bowl parade. But that's the problem with spot coverage. You gotta say something. And the somethings, and you know, they weren't going to let her wade into the crowd and start interviewing people. And before the cops did that, maybe she did. I don't know. But they were not going to be allowed to get close enough to let people make their make statements of a moral and ethical nature about the fact that the President of the United States is engaged in a conspiracy to commit crimes against humanity. That if we had a functioning republic and the Constitution was not already long in crisis, would have been dealt with by the other branches of the government. But hey, what do you want when Republicans control everything? Let's see. By the way, Jack in Shreveport with a question about gerrymandering. Does the presumption of not being racist override something like pattern and practice? Of course it does if you're a Republican. Now, understand, if there was a legislature that gerrymandered, that deliberately gerrymandered Republicans right out of their votes, the thugs on the Supreme Court would have a real big sad, and you'd get an immediate response, probably injunctive relief, and maybe even cookies and cupcakes sent to the poor aggrieved. Economically anxious maggots. Yes. Jack asks, how many racistly designed districts in a state does it take before SCOTUS thinks things might be racist? Well, there is no such number, Jack, because the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States has long held the position that there really isn't any such thing as racism in the United States, after all, anymore, because, among other things, we had a black president and people can sit at lunch counters if they want to now. Mm-hmm. So you get the idea. Steve in New York with a note says, Bob, we can't have people, and God forbid the poor, protesting our betters. Remember, there's only one amendment left in the Bill of Rights. They transferred the others to the Bill of Wrongs. Everyone's equal. Some are more equal than others. And the ones that are more equal than others are white and have guns and, sadly, quite frequently use them. Oh, by the way, a little story of somebody you've never heard of. Adam Lichten, L-I-C-H-T-I-N, Adam Lichten, He's been busted. He's a Berkshire Hathaway real estate broker. Used to work for Trump International Realty and the Corcoran Group. According to the New York Post, he got busted for squirreling away and stashing weapons in his apartment in New York. He had been, he had a little domestic violence problem, because back in November he got arrested for beating his wife. And so the police paid a little visit to the apartment to check on her when the guns were found. There were two shotguns and an AR-15. I'm sure that's apropos of absolutely nothing. But sooner or later, we have to address the elephant in the room. Annapolis, Maryland. Five dead. Others maimed. We know we have very little in the way of details about the entire circumstances surrounding the attack on the Capital Gazette offices in Annapolis. It was a newspaper. It is a newspaper. The shooter, after slaughtering at least five people, the shooter was taken into custody. I mean, he didn't stick the muzzle of the gun in his mouth and pull the trigger or anything. Because after all, he probably has something to say. We know very little about the shooter. Here's what we know. He, in other words, a male, is in his 20s. In other words, so far, male and in his 20s fits the usual pattern with mass killers in this country. And he's a male who's in his 20s and white. And so that sort of completes the mass murder trifecta. One individual was on the scene. In the office doing his job. A reporter by the name of Phil Davis tweeted while the about his experience during the expression of Second Amendment freedom. Phil Davis said, "I'll tweet what I can while I wait to be interviewed by police. The gunman shot through the glass door to the office and opened fire on multiple employees. Can't say much more. Don't want to declare anyone dead. But it's bad." And then offered up this observation. "There is nothing more terrifying than hearing multiple people get shot while you're under your desk. And then you hear the gunman reload." He did let people know. He said, "I'm currently waiting to be interviewed by police, so I'm safe and no longer at the office." It's too early to speculate as to causes or motives, but of course that doesn't slow down a scumbag like the life support system for a haircut, Sean Hannity job. Oh, no. Knowing almost nothing about the shooting, the Hannity job could not wait to unlimber himself of what he understood to be the facts as they exist inside the thin gray settlings that slosh around between his ears and pass for brains. Information perhaps passed to him from the amorphous, multi-limbed beings of Norblap 9 through the fillings in his teeth.
By the way, we're getting some breaking news that there was a shooting at the, it's called Capital Gazette newspaper in Annapolis, Maryland. The Baltimore Sun is now reporting. We have multiple deaths also being reported, and the sheriff is saying the multiple fatalities in a newsroom shooting. Oh, good grief.
Good grief.
So scary. The suspect, though, has been apprehended, according to the sheriff. And we'll continue to follow that story. It's so sad that there are so many sick, demented, and evil people in this world.
See, the piece should have ended right about, oh, here.
The suspect, though, has been apprehended, according to the sheriff. And we'll continue to follow that story.
Because that's really all there is. I mean, we do know a little bit more now. 20s, white, male. But maybe the Hannity job didn't have that available to him at the moment. But he's a multimillionaire, for-profit media broadcaster of hate, invective, and innuendo. So, naturally, he had to continue.
It's so sad that there are so many sick, demented, and evil people in this world. It really is sad. You know, imagine you go to work and this is what you're dealing with today.
Yeah, it's just sad. It's not like it's preventable. It's not like there's any sort of data to suggest who and why and how these things happen. It's just sad, and it's because there are sick, demented people in this world. There's nobody out there, like, say, the Hannity job, the life support system for a haircut, who persistently and almost constantly eggs these sick, demented people on. No, no, of course not. Because, after all, if you press him on it, he'll use the Limbaugh defense. My friends, I am only an entertainer. Right?
Some crazy person comes in.
Yeah, crazy. Got to be crazy. That's the only possible answer. Couldn't be any other sort of answer. No, of course not.
And I'm not turning this into a gun debate. I know that's where the media will be in 30 seconds from now. That's not it. You know, as I've always said, I mean, honestly.
Yeah, you know, it's never a gun debate with the Hannity job. Because we can't talk about the sacred guns. We can't talk about the holy handguns. We can't talk about the AR-15s and the assault rifles of blessed redemption. We can't talk about the NRA's roulette wheel of death, you know, the National Rifle Association. Can't talk about that.
I've been saying now for days that something horrible is going to happen because of the rhetoric.
Oh, wait, it turns out the Hannity job does know whose fault it is. Of course he does. If there was a sick, demented person, and now we know, yes, he's about, are you on the edge of your seats, brothers and sisters of the Horn Family Community Congregation? Are you just waiting in breathless anticipation to find out why this shooting took place? Well, wonder no more.
You know, as I've always said, I mean, honestly, I've been saying now for days that something horrible is going to happen because of the rhetoric. Really, Maxine, you want people to call your friends, get in their faces, and Obama said that too, get in their faces, call them out, call your friends, you know, get protesters, follow them into restaurants and shopping malls and wherever else she said.
Yeah. You know what Maxine Waters didn't say? Blow their fucking brains out. She didn't say that. She didn't say, as apparently the Republicans think Jesus did, take up thy AR-15 and follow me. She didn't say that. And she specifically said, be peaceful about it. But you got to remember that your average garden variety maggot is, of course, a delicate and special snowflake who cannot argue on a level playing field as to the validity of their positions, and instead, when challenged, tends to go and murder people. Oops. But that's right, that's right. It took almost... the blood was still wet on the floors of the Capital Gazette as the Hannity job, the life support system for a haircut, declared that Maxine Waters was to blame for this shooting. And, of course, it is the fondest wish of the Hannity job, the life support system for a haircut, that one of his gunned-up, amosexual, gundamentalist followers will maybe do something. And then, like I said, Hannity will say, well, I couldn't possibly foresee that. I mean, crazy people do that kind of thing. You know, the kind of crazy people who hear God talking to them. But again, based on what we talked about last night, it's no longer crazy, according, it's never crazy when God talks to you. That, according to the Vice President of the United States and any number delicately sensibilitied maggots. Mm-hmm. So, in short, because Sarah Hasselbeck Sandbags got asked to pull her front trotters out of the trough at a little restaurant in Virginia, and because Maxine Waters then said that if you are going to participate, and I'm paraphrasing here, if you're going to participate in and speak approvingly of and provide cover for the commission of crimes against humanity, that it's okay to challenge people for doing that, because this is a rowdy and vibrant republic, largely founded upon the right to free speech, free expression, freedom of assembly. That's why there's five dead people in Annapolis, Maryland. Yeah. Now, again, just to recap, since she said what she said last weekend, Auntie Maxine has been the recipient of numerous credible death threats. And I say they're credible because when they come from the White Wing, they're coming from people with a shit ton of firearms. And remember, on July the 16th, I believe it is, a guy from San Pedro, California, will be sentenced in federal court for having called and threatened to murder Representative Waters. Recall that the charge carries up to 10 years in prison, but that the person who made the threat probably will never see the inside of a goddamn jail, because I-O-K-I-Y-A-M. It's okay if you're a maggot. Are we clear? By the way, the white male in his 20s, at present, as of last report, is refusing to share his name with authorities. Doesn't wish to be identified. I don't know, maybe he forgot to scrub his Facebook account of all the... Because if Sean Hannity can do it, by God, I can too. Maybe he forgot to scrub his Facebook account of all the pro-Trump posts and all the MAGA posts, and maybe some Confederate flag pictures, and maybe some racist musings, and it, you know, that sort of thing. Uh-huh. Yeah. But the bottom line is that we have five more recipients of the Wayne LaPierre National Rifle Association Natural Manure Medal for their contribution of their life's blood to the feeding of the Tree of Liberty, which the National Rifle Association reminds us constantly must be watered from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. One may assume that the people simply doing their job at the Capitol Gazette were not tyrants. They must therefore have been patriots, and therefore they are recipients of the Natural Manure Award. This does not, this incident, however, does not exist in a vacuum. It has background. It was only 10 days ago that Julius Geezer, in a speech, referred to journalists in this country as America's enemy. I wonder what that sounds like in the original Russian. America's enemy. And of course, we documented it on this program over the course of the campaign. The very fine Nazis that attended his rallies and screamed, "Lügenpresse!" A word made infamous by German Nazis in the rise to power and consolidation of power of Adolf Hitler, to describe a free press that reported on the atrocities being committed in that rise and consolidation, the Lügenpresse. The lying press, which got translated into maggot as fake news. Because, of course, if you purvey something that is fake, that means de facto that you're lying. And the news is produced by the what we euphemistically refer to as the press. And so, in a way, fake news is a direct translation of the German phrase, Lügenpresse. And so, yeah, 10 days ago, the chlamydia Claudius referred to the press as America's enemy. And now 5 people who work in the press are dead, and a number of others maimed. But today, of course, he sent out a tweet. "Prior to departing Wisconsin, I was briefed on the shooting at Capitol Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland. My thoughts and prayers are with the victims and their families. Thank you to all the first responders who are currently on the scene. Never mind the fact that every day I do everything I can to encourage these sorts of things to happen." Meanwhile, there's Milo Yiannopoulos, who, as much or more than anyone else in this country, abuses the holy hell out of the First Amendment. According to a publication called The Observer, Milo Yiannopoulos is fond of a restaurant in the Upper East Side of New York. It's called Beach Cafe. The Observer had a story on it, how the Upper East Side's Beach Cafe became a watering hole for Trump titans. Davis Richardson, writing today, said, "Spending a day at the beach, the Trump era's greatest stars bake in the sun, glasses of Chardonnay and French fries in hand, power brokers like White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow, Senator Lindsey Graham, and former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski relax beneath umbrellas, exchanging crumbs of gossip like currency. This watering hole for the vain and powerful is not somewhere in Southampton, but at New York's legendary Beach Cafe. Here, everybody speaks the same language, explained the restaurant's proprietor, David Goodside. Politics. Smack on the corner of 70th Street and 2nd Avenue in Manhattan, the Beach Cafe, known simply as the Beach to its Upper East Side clientele, is a place where politicians and CEOs nestle into lime green booths to enjoy views of cabaret shows and a taxidermic hammerhead shark, overcooked cheeseburgers and hurricanes whipped up by members of the president's inner circle. On one occasion, Lewandowski dined in the very next room as former Trump advisor Roger Stone after reportedly facilitating Stone's ousting from Trumpland. It goes on at length. The Beach Cafe is what downstairs at the 21 Club used to be, Stone told The Observer. A low-key place where movers and shakers from politics, business, theater, and media mix with the well-heeled locals. First opened in 1968 by two new Canaanite brothers, Bill and Tom White, the Beach was modeled after the Winged Foot Country Club in Mamaroneck, New York, combining old Hollywood with garden party culture. Yada, 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 yada. It's a favorite spot of people like Milo Yiannopoulos. Okay, I'm not going to sit here and share the whole thing. You can go read it, observer.com. But when asked to comment for the story on the Beach, he responded, Mark the date on the calendar. It's the 28th of June, 2018. This is also at Observer.com. The headline by Davis Richardson reads, Milo Yiannopoulos encourages vigilantes to start gunning journalists down. Milo Yiannopoulos has started issuing reporters threatening messages when asked to comment for stories. I can't wait for the vigilante squads to start gunning journalists down on sight. The right-wing nationalist, what a bullshit phrase that is, the little goddamn filthy Nazi, told Observer over text message in response to a longer feature in development about the story I just shared with you. When asked to elaborate on who specifically had upset him, Yiannopoulos explained that the statement was his, quote, standard response to a request for comment. He also sent the message to the Daily Beast's Will Sommer, in an article examining the struggling UK Independence Party. The same message, namely, I can't wait for the vigilante squads to start gunning journalists down on sight. And just so you'll know who he is, the article keeps referring to him as a nationalist. He's a Nazi. And last weekend, he bragged on Facebook and Instagram that he had sent $14.88 to the former fact-checker for The New Yorker, Talia Lavin. That number means something. 14 refers to the 14 words, which is a mantra for Nazis about securing a place for our little white children bullshit. And then the number 88, which represents Heil Hitler. Because H is the eighth letter of the Roman alphabet, and thus Heil Hitler, HH, is 88 numerically. It probably goes without saying that the former fact-checker for The New Yorker, Talia Lavin, is Jewish. Again, right, maybe jot it down. Milo Yiannopoulos, in a story datelined the 26th of June, 2 days ago. I can't wait for the vigilante squads to start gunning journalists down on site. Is that just typical to you? Is it just another day in the long nightmare descent of America into fascism in full toxic bloom? Or is it chilling? Is it a terrifying comment? Is it disgusting and bloodthirsty, vile and evil? I know, respect, and deeply care about a number of people who practice real, live, honest-to-God journalism. And I would feel safe in saying that with remarks like this out there from someone who is near and dear to Donald Trump, a man who refers to a free press as America's enemy, that there's probably not a journalist in America, a real one. I'm not talking about the people who work for that website that rhymes with light and fart, who will sleep very soundly tonight. There's going to be a lot of babies kissed tonight. The hugs before going off to work on Friday morning on among journalists might be just a little tighter than they ordinarily are. It redeems Yiannopoulos' comment, not at all, that he says that saying, "I can't wait for the vigilante squads to start gunning journalists down on site," is his standard response to a request for comment. It arguably makes it worse. I guess Milo has gotten a little bit of pushback. Because utilizing the Limbaugh defense, he claims it was only a joke. You know, I wasn't serious about wanting the vigilantes to start gunning down journalists. I mean, anybody can tell that's a joke. He said, I regret nothing I said. Oh, no, let's not do that. I regret nothing I said, though, of course, like any normal person, I'm saddened to hear of needless death. The truth, as always, is the opposite of what the media tells you. And he claimed that what he said was a joke. Now, I've read the quote to you two or three times now. Can you find the punchline in it? Where's the ha-ha-ha-ha-ha part? I can't wait for the vigilante squads to start gunning journalists down on site. Now, this statement was sent to a journalist at Observer via text message. In text messages, you can use emojis, like the laughing emoji, or the broadly grinning emoji, or the emoji that's laughing so that tears are running, laughing so hard it's crying. None of those things accompanied the text. But he does. I regret nothing I said. But it was a joke. My friends, it's just a matter of entertainment. I was only joking. Hey, it's worked for Limbaugh for decades. Right? Right. why wouldn't it work for a vile little racist Nazi like Milo Yiannopoulos? So, having said that it was all just a joke, he then said that, of course, it was the journalist's fault. If there turns out to be any dimension to this crime related to my private misreported remarks, they were not private. He sent them in a text message in response to a request for a comment about a goddamn restaurant. If there turns out to be any dimension, he thought it was private. He was talking to a journalist. The only time it's private between you and a journalist is when you both agree that it's off the record. If there turns out to be any dimension to this crime related to my private misreported remarks. Misreported? I'm sorry, above, he said, I stand by, I regret nothing I said. He admits he said it, so it wasn't misreported. The responsibility for that lies squarely and wholly with the Beast and the Observer for drumming up fake hysteria about a private joke with the verified liberals who pretended they thought I was serious. And then he went on and referred to journalists as vermin. And take, I don't know, maybe he was already listening to the Hannity job, because he said the shooter, you know, the 20-something white male, the lawful gun owner, is a demented left-winger. And, of course, if you'll check in with the civility police, you'll find that we're supposed to perhaps sing a chorus of Kumbaya, accompanied, of course, by a kazoo band playing behind us. I want to make absolutely clear, I do not and will not support violence or calls to violence, even against human scum like Milo Yiannopoulos. And for the most part, our side doesn't go around shooting up schools, movie theaters, and what have you. And I want no physical harm to come to Milo Yiannopoulos. Because that way lies madness. Based on the... it was just the other night in South Carolina, Stan, when a little granny in a muumuu in South Carolina, Stan, hauled out her F-word and told a CNN reporter to get the fuck out of here. We don't want you here. I'm sure she's already been in church on Wednesday and she'll be back again on Sunday. And they'll clap her on the back and attaway, Eunice. Eunice Jean. You sure did tell that CNN fake news reporter. MAGA to you, Eunice Jean. MAGA. Praise Jesus, MAGA. I love the fact... No, I don't love it. But I do find it interesting because I am a student of the art of word knowing. That the goddess of irony chose to compel Milo Yiannopoulos to insert the modifier needless in front of death. I am saddened to hear of needless death. But given that he doesn't know who was killed, he doesn't know if it was needless yet now, does he? Another survivor of the slaughter in Annapolis. Gave an interview to WJLA. He works in an office across from the Capital Gazette. He was on the phone with a client when he heard huge bangs. He offered a description of what he saw. And it's not pleasant, and it is terrifying. God Almighty.
And so we want to play that interview for you right now, because he's actually taking us inside the building to describe what he saw and what he heard.
I work in 888 Best Gate, right across the hallway from the Capitol Gazette.
What did you see? What did you hear?
So I was on the phone with a client and heard a loud noise, like an incredibly loud bang. And I poked my head around the corner of my desk so I could see out our front door into the front door of the Capitol Gazette. And I saw a guy. I saw a guy holding a gun. The door of the Capitol Gazette had been blown to pieces. It was in shattered pieces all on the carpet. And this guy was holding what looked like a big shotgun and moving across the entrance of the Capitol Gazette office, pointing the gun deeper into the office, like he was targeting people.
Keith, did that man say anything?
I have no idea. I heard some indistinct shouting after another couple minutes before there were some more gunshots, but he didn't. I mean, I only looked at him for a second, right? I ducked my head back behind the wall as soon as I saw the guy initially, but I didn't hear him say anything distinct.
After you tried to hide, what'd you do?
Called the police. And they got here really fast. I mean, they got here real fast. The police were here in a couple minutes, and they checked on us in our office, made sure we were okay, and told us to just hunker down. And they, I guess, got the guy pretty quick after that.
Are all the people in your office okay?
Everyone's okay, yep.
Did you see anyone get hurt?
I did. I looked around the corner a second time, and I saw a young woman who looked like she'd been hurt. She was on the ground.
Injured?
I mean, there was a bunch of blood on the floor, so I assume so.
Did you see the shooter get shot, or did you...
No. I saw him move across the entrance of the office, and that was it.
And then after you called the police, where'd you go from there?
We stayed in our office until a second group of police officers showed up. They actually broke down our office door, and then they escorted us out. You know, they escorted us out with our hands up over our heads. And we spent some time in the office building next to our building, and they just made sure we were all safe and then let us go.
The important takeaway out of that story: it seemed like he was targeting people. Capital Gazette. Maybe he was targeting some of those vermin reporters that Milo Yiannopoulos talks about. Our buddy Irish Dave says, Jesus, Bob, when confronted by armed fascism, you deny your right to self-defense? Just saying, seriously? LOL, seriously? Well, there's nobody in that room who would have been saved by a firearm, Dave. I said I'm nonviolent. Nonviolent is not the same thing as pacifist. I do not advocate violence in exchange for violence. And a claim of self-defense will not lie, for instance, against someone who goes and hypothetically blows away a vicious, loudmouthed young Nazi who is not at that point in time doing something of a violent nature. So I hope there's a little clarification there. Scott, for instance, subject line, calls for violence. Point of order, Senator. Would administering a molten lead enema to Milo Yiannopoulos until he decides to begin speaking in a manner that's consistent with dwelling in a reality-based reality be construed as violence? I'm asking for a friend. Well, you know, Milo has been chased out of at least one watering hole in New York. And now that people know where many of the high and mighty maggots are congregating, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that people maybe take a look at the beach and address themselves to these supporters of an ongoing crime against humanity. And then, of course, they will cry. And the civility patrol will wring their hands and clutch their pearls, utterly oblivious to the fact that confronting white supremacy, Nazism, and crimes against humanity in a nonviolent fashion beats the living hell out of an open civil war in this country. Yeah, that's exactly what he meant when he said needless deaths. Irish Dave said, so Milo is in favor of needed and timely deaths? Yeah, reminiscent of the phrase, I never killed a man that didn't need killing. Exactly. So here we are at 11 minutes past the hour. Again, we got $50 to finish June's fundraising. I'm sorry to be talking about it on the penultimate broadcast of the month of June. I'd hoped we would have been finished a week ago. But we're not. $50 to go. And so with that in mind, if there are five people at $10 apiece, there's no challenges on the table or anything like that. But when the $50 come in, I get to send a note to Ralph's, and then that means we finish the Trash Fitz Walker Stand Challenge for the sixth consecutive month. And that's a big deal. So let's take a break. If you'd like to engage in conversation, you are more than welcome to. Look. The number, everybody knows the number, I presume, 304-574-8178. Toll free, this includes Canada and Mexico. I don't think we've got any listeners in Mexico, but if we do, you're mighty welcome to participate. And that's 844-843-4676. 844-THE-HORN, THEHORN. And then again, from anywhere on the planet, Bob Kincaid Horn is my contact at Skype, and you can use that too. Once again, there is one phone line. It's first come, first served. If you want to talk about this, jump in. If others want to talk about, dial it, and as soon as you hear whoever is talking, hang up. Then you dial in and first come, first served. Maybe sometime in the future, there will be more phone lines. It would certainly be lovely if there were. Right now, there's one. So that's how it stands. We'll take a break. It is, of course, Thursday, so that means we've got the Green News Report from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And we'll see which way the conversation goes, because there's a lot more than another spin of the National Rifle Association's roulette wheel of death in this blood-soaked, more than half-mad nation. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. And me? Well, I'm Bob Kincaid.
I was a kid at school. I messed around with all the rules. Apologized then, realized I'm not different after all. Me and the boys thought we had it sussed. Valentino's all of us. My dad said we look ridiculous, but boy, we broke some hearts. In and out of jobs, running free, waging war with society. Dumb blank faces stare back at me, but nothing ever changed. Promises made in the heat of the night, creeping home before it got too light. I wasted all that precious time and blamed it on the wine. I was only joking, my dear, looking for a way to hide my fear. What kind of fool was I? I could never win, never win. Never found a compromise. Collected lovers like butterflies. Illusions of that grand first prize are slowly wearing thin. Susie, baby, you were good to me, giving love unselfishly. But you took it all too seriously. I guess it had to end. I was only joking. It's pointless going on. I'd rather be alone. 'Cause what I'm doing must be wrong. Pouring my heart out in a song. Owning up for prosperity for the whole damn world to see. Quietly now,
while I turn a page. Act one is over without costume change. The principal would like to leave the stage. The crowd don't understand.
It's Thursday, June 28, 2018.
We will vote to confirm Justice Kennedy's successor this fall.
Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement is bad news for the climate.
For the people who live here, there's nothing to come home to. Burn to scrap and ash.
New wildfires hit Northern California and five other states. Federal judge dismisses San Francisco's climate liability lawsuit. Plus,
when we decide to take action, the world by default gets better.
Bright spots in the primaries as progressive climate hawks win upset victories.
All of that upset and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Nature is not a political game.
It is now, Governor Brown, and the bad guys just rolled Yahtzee. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, lots of concerns about whoever the replacement may be for Justice Anthony Kennedy, and of course, concerns about the climate along with it.
Yep. Kennedy's retirement from the U.S. Supreme Court is an ominous development that could bring about sweeping changes to both U.S. environmental law and the federal government's authority to address climate change. So it's potentially bad not just for the nation, but for the planet and future generations because of the need to act on climate right now. Justice Kennedy's record was pretty positive overall on environmental protection. He was the crucial fifth vote in the landmark ruling Massachusetts versus EPA, which upheld the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to regulate the greenhouse gases that cause dangerous climate change. A more conservative Supreme Court could overhaul established public health protections like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and even the Endangered Species Act. And significant climate policy and pollution lawsuits are now headed to the U.S. Supreme Court, like President Obama's Clean Power Plan that set the first ever carbon emission standards for power plants. Bottom line, adding another anti-environment, anti-regulation, right-wing justice like Neil Gorsuch to the bench will likely push the court to further restrict the scope of federal authority and limit environmental justice.
You know, I wish I had a snarky comment here, but I really don't.
I don't blame you. Speaking of justice, a climate liability lawsuit against major oil companies that was brought by the cities of San Francisco and Oakland was dismissed by a federal judge this week. The cities were seeking damages to pay for the costs and impacts of rising sea levels. In his ruling, District Court Judge William Alsup called the dangers of climate change, quote, very real, and noted that the fossil fuel companies did not dispute that burning their products causes global warming. But he said that it is a global problem that requires a global solution beyond the court's power to provide, and said that Congress and the executive branch must solve it.
Oh, well, that should go very well.
So ExxonMobil, BP, and Chevron escaped blame for those public costs, but other ongoing climate liability lawsuits continue to wend their way through state and local courts.
So this is just one judge who turned down this suit. Other judges may see it completely differently?
That's correct.
Of course, if they do, those cases, I suspect, will go all the way to the Supreme Court, and then they'll die.
We'll just have to see.
Too cynical?
Meanwhile, four new wildfires have erupted in Northern California amid high winds and high temperatures, including one less than 20 miles away from the catastrophic and deadly Wine Country fires last fall that obliterated entire neighborhoods. The Pawnee Fire has already destroyed homes and forced thousands to evacuate. It is Lake County, California's fourth major wildfire in just 4 years. Mm. A new study concludes that U.S. oil and gas drillers are leaking far more methane than previously estimated by the federal government, some 60% more. Led by the Environmental Defense Fund, the study, published in the journal Science, estimates that about $2 billion worth of natural gas is lost to leaks every year in the United States, enough to heat 10 million homes. Because methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, it has a big impact on climate change. But the good news, the authors say, is that most of the leakage can be stopped at relatively low cost to industry. Finally, there is a bright spot of good news.
I'll take it.
Progressive climate hawk candidates scored upset victories in 2018 primary elections this week. In Utah, Navajo Kenneth Maryboy unseated incumbent Rebecca Benally for San Juan County Commissioner. Benally supported the Trump administration's gutting of the Bears Ears National Monument boundaries against the wishes of the majority of Navajo tribal members in the state.
And the voters tossed her out?
Yes, they did.
Good for them.
And in the New York primary, progressive candidate and climate hawk Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won the Democratic nomination for House District 14 against longtime incumbent Democratic Representative Joe Crowley. Ocasio-Cortez calls for transitioning the nation to 100% renewable electricity by 2035.
Go Alexandria. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and please share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Hold your head up.
Almost exactly halfway through the program, and hallelujah, glory, thank you very kindly to Samson. Thank you, Samson, so very much. We are done with fundraising for the month of June, a day ahead of, well, actually 4 days behind schedule, but a day ahead of the last day of June, meaning we have qualified for the sixth month in a row for the Trash Fits Walker Stand Challenge, courtesy of Ralph's. Thank you so much, Samson. That takes, well... It takes a lot of the weight off. It simply does. A little more detail coming out of Annapolis. Katie Watson at CBS tweeted, a law enforcement source tells one of my CBS News colleagues that the Annapolis shooting suspect damaged his fingertips so law enforcement cannot identify him that way. The source says smoke bombs and flashbangs were found in a backpack. Law enforcement official confirms in press conference that suspect is still not identifying himself. Quote, we do know he's a white male, an adult male. Gosh, you'd almost think that it was planned, wouldn't you? It burned it. Really? Because isn't that an old trick from the mob or what? To use acid to burn your fingerprints off. Jesus. It's probably, you know, it's like Milo Yiannopoulos. It's probably some leftist. Right. I'm gonna depart from that story for a minute. And by the way, you know, phone lines are open if you want to talk. I'm going to depart because I've got another somebody calling 911 or calling the cops on black people not doing anything wrong. This, of course, comes from the Old Dominion of Virginia, where some folks, including a young man by the name of Jordy Henderson, had gotten some carry out from Chili's, you know, chain restaurant. And when he and his buddies had picked up their carryout, they stood in the parking lot a little bit afterward and chatted, just talked. Well, that's when the cops showed up and rousted him. There's video. It's, hey, nobody got murdered, okay? So, you know, that's a win.
The other son. She got in the tree. Yeah, she was in the tree. Like, literally in the tree.
Hello.
They said they're closing the inside, and they'd like you all to leave the property.
Why? Oh, yeah, they close at 11.
Yeah.
Yeah, we wake up.
I know you, and I went to school with you.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you just
it's
like
10:50.
This.
We sitting out here talking to our friend. She came from my
right.
building.
Right, that's cool.
All we doing is talking, bro.
Yeah, people like that. Talk
my too, my little homeboy in there just came outside and told me, yeah. Oh, they think y'all trying to intimidate somebody. And somebody said, for what?
Right,
we can't,
right.
Because we black and we talking.
No.
But they just had some white ladies standing right there talking.
Like I said, look, all we doing is, it's their property. It's private property. They can decide who they want here and who they don't want here.
They didn't even ask us to leave. Why they called the police?
Listen, that's fine.
I don't know, okay? I guess
I'm going to get corporate number, that's all.
Look, well, no, they don't want you inside.
Why can't go inside?
I mean, this is their problem.
Hold on. You got this on live?
Uh-huh.
Now, yeah. I can't go inside. Why?
They don't want you in there.
Why? What did I do?
Sir, I can't explain that to
you. So can you go ask her? I can't go in this.
I mean, the cops are being halfway decent. They haven't tasered anybody or sprayed anybody or shot anybody in the head. Or, as was the case with the young teenager fleeing in Pittsburgh a few days ago, they haven't shot him 3 times in the back. But it's still troubling. It's still problematic because white folks do this all the time and don't get the cops called on them. And arguably, a parking lot is not specifically the unless the Chili's is the only one thing that's there, and very seldom are Chili's the only thing that's there. It's not expressly their property. So expect some sort of statement from corporate in the near future. Because, among other things, Jordy Henderson said, you can spend your money at Chili's if you want to, but my black ass works too hard to give Chili's another dollar after being treated the way I was. As you heard, you know, when they said they didn't even ask us to leave, why are they calling the police? Yeah, the police really didn't have an answer. Jesus, America. So let me contrast this with a story of my own. Happened today. And I actually engaged in considerable thought about this before I did anything. Now, I've told you that I live about a few miles from the longest single arch bridge in the Western Hemisphere. It's the New River Gorge Bridge. It's a tourist attraction. It's also a suicide magnet, but let's leave that alone. It's 976 feet above the floor, above the New River in the gorge. It is engineered to be able to sway up to 7 feet side to side in hurricane force winds. And I've been on that bridge in high winds, and it is a moving experience. And at 976 feet above the gorge, there's always a wind blowing on the bridge. Always. And this is a tourist area. And by the way, I don't know the outcome of this, but there are rules. There are rules about the usage of the bridge. For instance, once a year, we shut down one half of the bridge, two of the four lanes, and people with more dollars than cents come and jump off of it with parachutes. It's called base jumping. And, you know, hundreds of people will jump on Bridge Day, third Saturday in October, every year. And it's the largest single-day festival in the state of West Virginia. Starts about 8 o'clock in the morning, wraps up about 3 in the afternoon. And it's a good time. It's also kind of a claustrophobic time at the height of things, because when you've got 100,000 people on two lanes of a one-mile-long bridge, it can get a little creepy. But it's a chance to walk out on the bridge and look down into the gorge when most of the when the rest of the year you have to just keep driving. Emphasis on the word driving. Because pedestrians are not allowed on the bridge. Bicycles are not allowed on the bridge. Cars and motorcycles, trucks, you know, motorized vehicles are allowed on the bridge. And it is beginning, you know, about late March, early April, with the arrival of what can brutally be referred to as the beginnings of spring, our tourism season picks up and runs till about the aforementioned third Saturday in October when Gauley River rafting season ends. But there's all kinds of ecotourism here. This has become an absolute magnet for rock climbers in the gorge, and in the gorge of the Meadow River as well. And there's bicycling and hiking. Agnes and I have been trying to take advantage of some of the hiking trails. So today I had to go across the river, and the way you go across the river is going across the New River Gorge Bridge on US 19. And so I headed out and I took my usual route. It's sort of a back way to 19. And almost out to the highway, I noticed that there was a van pulled over on the side of the road, and it said something about cycles. And then I slowed way the hell down because there were a bunch of bicyclists. And I'm not one of those assholes who refuses to share the road with people on bicycles. And so there was a whole bunch of them riding, and apparently once I got out to the highway, there were even more riding. And yeah, you can ride your bicycle on US 19 too. You cannot, however, ride your bicycle onto the New River Gorge Bridge. I will say by way of preface, we don't get a lot of people of color engaging in the ecotourism here in the New River Gorge area. All the bicyclists that I saw were white folks. And it's no big deal. I mean, it's a great place to come and like mountain biking, and this was road riding. So what? But then, son of a bitch. Sorry, bad phrase, but sneaks it. Son of a gun, I notice that these cyclists, I see a group of them, and they're northbound on 19 on the and they're coming off of the bridge. They've ridden from Fayetteville across the bridge. And then I get onto the bridge, and if this makes me out to be an asshole, I apologize. I get onto the bridge, and there's a cluster of them who have stopped smack dab in the middle of the bridge, over on the very narrow shoulder of it, and they're all just taking in the sights and looking down into the gorge. And I was kind of flabbergasted. Because nobody in their right mind would ride a bicycle onto that bridge. Like I said, there are always winds on that bridge. And they're winds that are sufficient to shove around vehicles. I've seen tractor trailers crossing the bridge, and they get moved by the winds from the right lane slowly into the left lane. I've driven across that bridge in gale force winds when I had the steering wheel of my vehicle turned at about 45 degrees just to stay in the lane that I was in. One good gust and one of those bicycles blows into traffic, and then it's a horror. I'm not one of these rule-oriented people, but every now and then you do run across a rule that actually makes sense, like don't ride your fucking bicycle onto the New River Gorge Bridge, especially a cluster of you. So if it makes me an asshole, I guess I'll just have to deal with it, but it seemed like at the time, it seemed like the right thing to do. And I picked up my phone. I dialed 911. I got the dispatch, and I said, "Listen, I know this is for emergencies, and I'm not trying to misuse the system. You tell me to hang up, I'll hang up. But there's about 10 bicyclists out in the middle of the New River Gorge Bridge, and there's a whole bunch more headed that way. And the dispatch guy said, well, this is the first we've heard of it. I said, again, he said, no, you're not misusing it. No, we're glad you called. Somebody could get killed out there. There's a reason you're not supposed to be on the bridge on a bicycle. Hope the hell now I'm not, I hope I'm not Bicycle Bob. But these were people who were obviously, as we say here in the hills, not from around here, but who didn't know that you don't ride a bicycle out. No, you don't. And it's pretty clearly marked. And so the dispatch guy said, yeah, we'll get a cruiser out there. I said, you know, be nice. You know, don't be mean to them or anything. Oh, we won't. But they can't. And he said, they can't be out there. I mean, splatting cyclists is something that I generally and entirely disagree with. But my God, there's a huge difference between making that call and freaking out because some people are standing around talking to a friend they haven't seen forever outside of goddamn Chili's, or because an 8-year-old little girl is selling bottles of water. I guess Permit Patty would have dropped a dime on Lucy. You know, of course, you know, Lucy was wrong colored. You know, from the Peanuts comic strip, if she was sitting there, you know, with her psychiatry practice there. Well, that's the unauthorized practice of medicine's what that is. There's lots of great places to ride bicycles around here. It's just that the New River Gorge Bridge isn't one of them. I mean, the speed limit on that bridge is 65 miles an hour. The draft from vehicles passing alone it presents a challenge. So, I mean, that's my 911 story. And, you know, I was driving and operating hands-free and stuff, so it's not like I could look up the regular number. But by God, if one of them had gotten splattered, it would have been a 911 situation. I mean, I don't fully know how to categorize doing something like that. Because it wasn't just one person doing it, it was a manifestation of group ignorance. And they were obviously having a blast, you know, they had their cycling racing jerseys on. A couple of people had different nationalities jerseys on. And when I first saw them, all I thought was, I so do not want to pick up the newspaper tomorrow and find out that a bunch of bicyclists got squished or blown off of the New River Gorge Bridge. Because, you know, bicycles aren't worth a shit as a parachute. Yeah, it is. It's an actual federal highway. Arnold says this, if it's an actual federal highway, bicycles aren't permitted. There are stoplights up into Fayetteville, but there's no stoplight between Summersville and Fayetteville. There are no on and off ramps, but it is a U.S. highway. And, you know, you see bicycles on it from time to time. But yes, I've never seen them on the bridge before. The bridge is the hang up. There's a nice broad shoulder on the highway itself, you know, whatever. and you have to cross the highway on that one road that I was coming out on to get over to the Lansing Edmond side and go up to Burrito Bar and have a good time. Yeah, Arnold says, like I-81, you can't ride your bicycle on I-81. No, you can't. And there's a pretty damn good reason for it. You also can't drive your motorboat on the highway. Oh, you don't know what you ask, Tony. Tony wants a bumper to go with this. And I don't know if this is going to be the right one, because it's a mess. Is it? Let's see. Nope. There it is.
Bicycle. I want to ride my white. You say bar, I say bite. You say shark, I say him. And Jaws was never my scene, and I don't like Star Wars. You say Rose, I say Royce. You say God, give me a choice. You say Lord, I say Christ. I don't believe in Peter Pan, Frankenstein, or Superman.
But not upon the New River Gorge Bridge.
To ride my bicycle.
I don't want to fall 976 feet.
Races are coming your way. So forget all your duties, oh yeah. Run for the girls, they'll be riding today. So look out for those beauties, oh yeah. On your marks, get set, go!
God, I love the sound that he got out of that guitar, and of course, the immortal Freddie Mercury. But damn, I mean, well, thank you, Robert in Australia says, sounds like you did the right thing. Are there signs that say no bikes on the bridge? Yes. Wasn't the whole song, Tony, but just enough to provide some. Some necessary context. Lee in New York says, people being safe. I hate to tell you how many times I see people being stupid. Einstein told us it's infinite. For example, I've seen people driving in my area at night with no lights at all. That means they do not see that the dashboard is unlit. You heard of the Darwin Awards? I never knew that the Darwin Awards had a peddling component. Well, thanks, Asa, calling me a bicycle Nazi. It had to happen, didn't it? Sure it did. No, I'll just say this simply. No, I would not have never, ever, ever, Larry, not even a little bit. Not even with yours. No. So that's that. The trouble with these roulette wheel stories is that it's hard to get loose from them. Because they sort of create their own, they create their own gravity wells. Like having, lying Sarah Sanders declare that, it was awful, the attack on innocent journalists doing their job. When in point of fact, you know, the man that she works for, the man that she lies for every day of her miserable existence, Sarah Hustlebuck Sandbags, do you ever look at your boss and say, maybe you should stop calling the media and the free press in this country an enemy of the state? Maybe. No, of course Sarah doesn't. Hell no. Well, I'd like to think that didn't hit. But you know what? Asa says, can you imagine if one of those cyclists is listening and they just found out you're the one who ratted them out? Well, you know, that's fine. I'm also the one who may have saved their freaking lives. Fools. Arnold says, before you got to the 911 part, I was so in love with the idea of going there and riding across the bridge. Well, that's really not going to happen, but you know what? Come here for Bridge Day, Arnold, and walk out on the bridge. It's equally compelling. And beside, there's great carnival barker food, all kinds of, you know, all kinds of good stuff that you, like, you usually buy at the county fair, and you know, deep fried misery and whatnot. Oh, well played, Lee. Lee says maybe you should have contacted Bicycle Repairman from the Monty Python skit. Scott in San Diego using the correct vernacular. You were correct to harsh their chill, Bob. As a general rule, people like that, the bike riders, tend to piss me off. Many seem to be of the mindset that rule doesn't apply to me, so I'll ignore it. In the final analysis, it's Trump's fault. He's the chief North American distributor of double standard. Damn, I didn't even try to wrap that into being Donald Trump's fault. That takes some fairly special abilities, Scott. For that, you get a cowbell. Absolutely. That's right, you can, Arnold. You can go base jumping. And this is a beautiful, beautiful place. Summersville Lake is magnificent. When it's nice and calm in the summertime, you know, seeing people on the stand-up paddle boards and kayaking all over the place, you can rent a kayak. It's great. And then at the end of the day, you go over to the Grove and have some craft beers and listen to a good band, and you get ready to go home the next day, and you say, I have not had an adventure trip like that in my entire life. I mean, it's pretty cool. There's one trail you can walk down. It's an old narrow gauge rail trail, and you can literally walk down through hundreds of millions of years of geology from top to bottom, or bottom to top, for that matter. If you ever wondered what it's actually like inside an underground coal mine, you can go to the Beckley Exhibition Coal Mine, which is one of the, if not the only, places where you can go underground and see what it was like 60, 70, 80, 100 years ago in the hell on earth that was coal mining. And you won't even get blown up. So there's that. But I hope that I didn't do the wrong thing, and I feel fairly confident that I didn't. Ron in Raleigh says, I work on campus at North Carolina State University. If you want to see some egregious bicycling, college campuses are the best place. Wrong way on one-way streets, crossing against the light, running stop signs, and every other conceivable bad behavior. If you ride on the streets, you're supposed to follow the same rules as cars. That's true. And in some cases, you're just not supposed to go places that cars can go. Like that. Bicycle Bob. Jeez. Yeah, Isaac. Bicycle Snitch Bob. And honestly, the inquiry that went through my mind was, okay, I just ignore this and blow on past them, and I feel really awful tomorrow if I find out a few of them got splattered because they were too stupid to know that they shouldn't ride a bicycle out onto a limited access highway bridge 976 feet in the air with a constant gust. Sometimes, you know, sometimes choices are binary in nature. Hope I didn't ruin their trip. I hope they didn't, you know, I didn't want them ticketed or anything. Just explain to them that you're doing something extremely dangerous and threatening to your own life beyond the ordinary dangers of bicycling among automobiles. So, yeah, there we go. Like I said, it's tough to get past these slaughter stories, but there are other things. You may recall that when I opened the program talking about the protest at the Hart Senate office building that began at the Department of Justice and included a march and then a sit-in at Hart. Even though the CNN lady didn't mention it. A number of the women there had signs that said, abolish ICE. Among other things, that was a central plank of the campaign of Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez in New York, who won the other night. I'm proud for her. Happy for her. Well, maybe ICE should be abolished. Yeah. I know one bad apple, et cetera, et cetera. But still, this is a pretty disturbing damn story. It comes out of Seattle. The dateline is today. Apparently, the sentencing was today. I don't have the follow-up. There was a sentencing in Seattle in federal court today for Rafael Sanchez. No. Rafael Sanchez was not one of the illegals that the maggots hoot and shriek over. No, Rafael Sanchez was one of those folks who live up in the thin oxygen. Rafael Sanchez was legal counsel for ICE. And it was Rafael Sanchez's job to oversee deportation and asylum hearings for immigrants in four states in the American West. In essence, having the power of life and death over other human beings who came to this country to try to avoid being killed in their own. He wasn't just some lawyer, he was the lawyer, the head lawyer for ICE in Seattle. And today, or previously, he entered a guilty plea to wire fraud and aggravated identity theft. Jesus. What he had done is he had stolen the identities of the immigrants that he was tormenting and prosecuting. And then he used those stolen identities to engage in bank fraud and credit card fraud. How about that? Who knew that an undocumented immigrant could get a credit card? But, well, I guess. He engaged in more than one instance of it. Department of Justice lawyers directing comments to U.S. District Judge Robert Lasnik said, Sanchez betrayed his trust. And then, this is the one that sticks. Over a period of years, he exploited numerous victim aliens, defrauded major financial institutions, and monetized his position of public trust. to use the identities of at least 7 particularly vulnerable immigrants facing deportation, including the photo of a murdered woman, to forge IDs. That was at the heart of the prosecution's case. A period of years. His total haul was over $190,000 from at least 6 different banks and financial institutions via his use of the stolen identities. Here's a question, and I know what the answer is. Do the immigrants who got their identities stolen, do they get to, maybe as a consolation prize alongside a year's supply of Rice-A-Roni, the San Francisco treat, get to stay in the United States? Of course not. The wire fraud charge carries a maximum prison term of up to 30 years, a fine of up to $1 million. There's a mandatory 2-year sentence for aggravated identity theft. Federal prosecutors and the defense attorneys, however, have reached an agreement. The prosecutors and the defense attorney are recommending that Rafael Sanchez serve no more than 4 years in prison in an agreement that does not bind the federal judge at the time of sentencing. By way of trying to provide her client a zealous defense, his lawyer, Cassandra Stamm, said he had a terrifying childhood, having moved to New Jersey from Puerto Rico as a toddler. And he grew up in a violent home with an alcoholic father. Unfortunately, she said, he never acquired the tools necessary to surmount the crippling psychological deficits that his childhood gave him. Four years. On a crime that carries up to 30 for stealing $190,000 from defenseless immigrants. So the blind justice lady apparently peeped out from behind the blindfold, because I think it's safe to say that an actual immigrant who had done something similar would A, be subjected to deportation, and B, if not deported, stuck in the federal in the federal prison system for something a hell of a lot nearer the maximum sentence. Disgusting. And then there are those deportation hearings themselves. Now, got to be fair about this. This is not something new. This is not something that happens only because Trump brought it on. It's been going on for years. It went on before Barack Obama went into office. And it went... it probably goes back to the reign of error of Dim Leader. It is a violation of the most fundamental tenets of what used to be our legal system. by way of example, let's say you're driving down the road. There are no bicycles involved in this. You're at a stoplight. Okay, you're at a stoplight. You're completely not at fault. And in the back seat there, in an approved and properly installed and properly used child safety seat, is your child. Let's say that child is 4 years old. And let's say you're sitting there at the red light when Cletus J. Maggot rear ends you. I use this example because there's no allegation of there's no way you can impute negligence or any improper driving to the person who's sitting there at a legal stoplight. But Cletus J. Maggot rear ends you, and you've got an accident. You've got a rear ender accident, bodily injury claim. Let's make it a not big one, because baby was properly seat belted and everything. But you and baby have a bodily injury claim. Maybe you went to the ER. Maybe you've got $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 worth of medical bills. For which, and it's a miracle, mind you, because Cletus J. Maggot actually had insurance. And so you go get a lawyer, and the lawyer gathers up your medical bills and gets a look at the nature of your injuries, and let's say you settle for $10,000 apiece. This is not a big accident. But there was damage, and there will probably be sequelae of the damage further down the road. Well, when it comes time, because you're not going to, the liability is clear and damages are clear, so the insurance company is not going to fight it, and you agree upon a sum, and instead of trying the case, you simply have to get it approved by a judge. Now, if it was just you, an adult, you would not have to get it approved by a judge, but a child of tender years, an infant below her majority, is involved. So the court will insist that what is called a guardian ad litem be appointed for the child to make sure that the settlement is fair and equitable to the child. Because the legal system is not willing to presume that the lawyer you hired is acting as much in the child's interest as in yours. Because the court is supposed to act first and foremost in the best interests of the child. Well, that lawyer, that guardian ad litem, will be appointed by virtue of an order entered by the court. The lawyer will then get the accident report and the hospital records and the doctor records and the x-rays and the what have you, and perform an entirely independent review of the claim and settlement process that your lawyer has engaged in. The insurance company will pay for the guardian ad litem. And then there will be a settlement conference hearing. And at that hearing, the judge will ask the guardian ad litem lawyer, have you reviewed all the relevant evidence? Have you reviewed the medical records, the documents? Have you reviewed the traffic, the accident report? Are you satisfied that this settlement is in the best interests of the child? And 9 times out of 10, the guardian ad litem will say, yes, Your Honor, I am so satisfied. And then the judge will say, okay, well, that being the case, I'm going to find that this is a fair and equitable settlement with regard to the child and to the adult. I'm going to approve the attorney's fees. I'm going to, guardian ad litem, if you'll submit your bill, I will also enter an order for those fees to be paid as well. And the case is pretty much over at that point. And all of this for a case in which the child was not grievously injured. But because we have legal standards that must be adhered to, in which we look out for the best interests of the child. I tell you all this by way of setting up what comes next. That best interest of the child stuff is completely out the window, doesn't matter, and is not considered where little migrant children are concerned. We have, right now, court cases going on at the border in which toddlers... And maybe you're going to be disinclined to believe this, so look it up for yourself. But toddlers are being expected to defend themselves. A 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, has to defend herself in deportation hearings held by the awesome majesty of the United States federal government. Take a moment and let that just sink in. Adults are not capable of defending themselves in such a setting. What kind of brute nation are we that we will not even provide a lawyer for a 3-year-old migrant child fleeing for her life? According to a report from PBS NewsHour, more little children, including toddlers, are being affected by this policy than ever before. 2,000 or more and more children who have been separated from their families will have to go through these court processes by themselves. And apparently that's okay in the land of the brave and the home of the free. Land of the free and the home of the brave, whatever. Asked for comment by PBS NewsHour, ICE had no comment. It used to be that the children would be included in their parents' claims and would stand up in the and would be heard in immigration court along with their parents. Now that we have a rolling series of crimes against humanity, that is no longer the case. Is that disgusting? Is it, no, is it as disgusting to you as it is to me? A little American child will get the benefit in a civil proceeding over a red car, blue car rear ender, will get the benefit of a legal system that is concerned with making sure that the child is getting enough money for its injuries. But a child fleeing the possibility, nay, the likelihood of having a bullet put through its brain in one of the most dangerous countries on earth that isn't the United States, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, that child must fend for itself in front of a lawyer with at least 7 years of post-secondary education. What does the court do when it, how do you plead, kid?
Mama.
Well, that's not guilty or not guilty.
Mama. Papa. Papa.
What's this kid talking about with this mama and papa crap? Sounds guilty to me. Now, as of Tuesday, a federal judge ordered the White House to reunify shattered families within 14 days if the child's under 5 and 30 days if the child's older than 5. The Trump regime will, of course, appeal this. The thing will probably stay in abeyance while it's under appeal. And maybe it'll go all the way to the Supreme Court, where Alito and Slappy Coke Can Thomas and Ann Gorsuch's boy Neil and John No Such Thing as Racism Roberts. And maybe it'll, I don't know, maybe it'll get all the way to the Supreme Court before July 31st, and the Kennedy kid can participate as well and say, hey, it's not our fault that kid doesn't know our legal system. Shouldn't have come here in the first goddamn place. You know, when you're a parent and you've got a 3 or 4 year old, you don't necessarily explain everything that you're doing to the 3 year old because there are some things that are beyond the ken of a 3 year old. Maybe you don't want to traumatize the 3 year old by saying to him, listen, we got to get out of here. We got to leave San Salvador right now. Because if we don't, mommy and daddy and you are going to wind up with a bullet behind their right ears. That's a little traumatizing. Heck, it might be traumatizing enough to make you grow up and steal the identities of other immigrants. You know, like Rafael Sanchez, who wasn't an immigrant, but was an American citizen, who was moved from Puerto Rico to New Jersey. But there is, beyond the existential horrors that are taking place at the border, we need to recall that there is also an administrative horror. Notices of hearings. Okay, we're not to the point yet, you know, granted, Julius Geezer says he just wants to get rid of the immigration courts and just wants to catch them and drag them back to the shithole countries they came from. That's his phrase. Don't need judges, Trump says. But we're not to the point yet where we're at what was known in England as the Court of Star Chamber, where you just convene the court and don't let anybody know about it. We still have these things called notice requirements. And a notice requirement is fulfilled by providing notice of the date and the time and the place of a hearing to a party to the hearing within a sufficient amount of time to give the party a reasonable opportunity to prepare a response to the court's action. It's all in writing. It's all on paper. There's a copy in the court file. The prosecution has a copy. And a 4-year-old toddler is also served with the notice. A 4-year-old toddler who toddler speaks probably Spanish and is served with a notice of hearing in English when the 4-year-old toddler speaks neither English, writes neither English nor Spanish because it's a 4-year-old toddler. Sadly, Steve Lee is a UCLA child psychology professor. Steve Lee said expecting children to advocate for themselves in court is an incredibly misaligned expectation. That's academic speak for that's some bullshit. Lee continued, that couldn't be any less developmentally appropriate. At all. It's absurd. It's Kafkaesque. Because we live in a time that would, if Kafka were around, he'd just look up and go, fuck it, I quit. I can't write anything more absurd than this. And meanwhile, those 2,000 children have been scattered from home to Rome. We got them in New York. We got them in Michigan. And their parents have no way of knowing where they are. And the ICE creeps talk about how they provide access or opportunity, which is not the same thing as parents knowing where their children are. And we know now that many of the adults who are given these children don't even speak Spanish. We know that they are prevented by rule from touching the children or giving them so much as a hug. I have a story that I've hung on to for a while. It comes from someone who knows firsthand the effects of separation of children from parents. A psychologist by the name of Yoko Verdonner. Writing at The Guardian, she said, the events occurring now on our border with Mexico, where children are being removed from the arms of their mothers and fathers and sent to foster families or shelters, make me weep and gnash my teeth with sadness and rage. I know what they're going through. When we were children, my two siblings and I were also taken from our parents, and the problems we've experienced since then portend the terrible things that many of these children are bound to suffer. My family was Jewish, living in 1942 in the Netherlands when the country was occupied by the Nazis. We children were sent into hiding with foster families who risked arrest and death by taking us in. They protected us, they loved us, and we were extremely lucky to have survived the war and been well cared for. Yet the lasting damage inflicted by that separation reverberates to this day, decades hence. Quote, have you heard the screams and seen the panic of a three-year-old when it has lost sight of its mother in a supermarket? That scream subsides when mother reappears around the end of the aisle. This is my brother writing in recent years. He tries to deal with his lasting pain through memoir. It's been 76 years, yet he revisits the separation obsessively. He still writes about it in the present tense. In the first home, I screamed for 6 weeks. Then I moved to another family, and I stopped screaming. I give up. Nothing around me is known to me. All those around me are strangers. I have no past. I have no future. I have no identity. I am nowhere. I am frozen in fear. It is the only emotion I possess now. As a three-year-old child, I believe that I must have made some terrible mistake to have caused my known world to disappear. I spend the rest of my life trying desperately not to make another mistake. My brother's second foster family cared deeply about him and has kept in touch with him all these years. Even so, he is almost 80 years old now and is still trying to understand what made him the anxious and dysfunctional person he turned into as a child and has remained for the rest of his life. A man with charm and intelligence, yet who could never keep a job because of his inability to complete tasks. After all, if he persisted, he might make a mistake again, and that would bring his world to another end. My younger sister was separated from our parents at 5. She had no understanding of what was going on and why she suddenly had to live with a strange set of adults. She suffered thereafter from lifelong profound depression. I was older, 7. I was more able than my siblings to understand what was happening and why. I spent most of the war with Dick and Ella Renders. Dick was mayor of a small rural village, and he and Ella lived in a beautiful house next to a wide waterway. Ella had a warm smile, and Dick referred to me as his oldest daughter. I was able to go to school normally, make friends, and became part of village life. I was extraordinarily lucky. But I was not with my own parents, sister, and brother. And eventually, I also had to leave the Renders, my loving second family. I was returning to my own family, but that meant another separation. In later life, I was never able to really settle down. I lived in different countries and was successful in work, but never able to form lasting relationships with partners. I never married. I almost forgot to mention my own anxiety and depression and many years in psychotherapy. My grief and anger about today's southern border come not just from my personal life. As a retired psychotherapist who has worked extensively with victims of childhood trauma, I know all too well what awaits many of the thousands of children taken by our government at the border who are now in processing centers and foster homes, no matter how decent and caring those places might be. I'll add editorially that it is a bit presumptuous to assume that they are all decent, that they are all caring. We can expect, she continues, thousands of lives to be damaged for many years or forever by zero tolerance. We can expect old men and women decades from now still suffering, still remembering, still writing in the present tense. What is happening in our own backyard today is as evil and criminal as what happened to me and my siblings as children in Nazi Europe. It needs to be stopped immediately. That account is important because it's not somebody who just knows a little history saying that that what's going on at the southern border under the commands and demands of the Trump regime is reminiscent of what the Nazis did. That's someone who lived through what the Nazis did, saying that what the Trump regime is doing is like what the Nazis did. It's a pity there's not some way whereby Republican members of the House and Senate can be compelled to listen to what she says. But then again, maybe they're Republicans after all, and maggots. Her words would very likely fall on deaf ears. Let's run over to the phones. 28 past the hour. Let's check in with Scott. Hey, Scott.
Hiya, Bob. Wow, that was a downer of a story.
Sorry, dude. I didn't mean to harsh your mellow.
I must chime in at the risk of pissing you off or somebody out there in the Great Horn congregation. I am perfectly understanding of the processes of the mind of a 3, 4, 5, 6, 7-year-old, something like that. I really wonder what benefit there is of a full-grown adult who for the past 60 or 70 or even 80 years has defined his or her life by an admittedly traumatic series of incidents, how that could possibly work for them in any positive, appropriate way. And what I mean by that is, and this is not why I called, but since we're on that topic via your reading of that item, it's worth mentioning another take on it. And what I mean by what I've said so far is that obviously, if life doesn't appear to be working when you're caught up in the vortex of madness and cruelty and an out of control set of circumstances, how could you possibly expect anything different or better to have that literally define one's existence all those years later? And maybe I'm off base for even putting it that way, but I've really got to, and what blew me away was the author, unless I misheard, was a practicing psychologist.
Yes.
You know, there's a thing in life called coming to grips with, or coming to terms with, or resolving to the best of one's ability, a chapter or a series of chapters in life, and learning from it, healing to the extent that's possible, and moving forward to whatever's next. And I don't know that I've got a solution for anybody caught up in that dynamic. I just think my Anglo-Saxon white Protestant upright God that I'm not stuck there, because I've had a number of chapters myself over the decades that, had I chosen to remain stuck in that feeling of being stuck or perception of being stuck, I would still be stuck. And to the extent that I'm unstuck, is a credit to seeing a more appropriate positive way. Well, that's not really why I called. But
well, but I'm not pissed off or anything. But I do want to push back a little bit, Scott, because I don't think she was saying that anybody's stuck. It's just naturally what happened as a result of what of the trauma that they went through.
In the form of lingering residue or something.
Yeah. That her brother was never able to hold down a decent job. It wasn't a character flaw. He wasn't predestined for that. That's a little too Calvinist, I think. Trauma, you know, if somebody breaks a bone, and the bone is not properly reset, and the person walks with a halting gait because one leg is now longer than the other. We don't say that that person failed to get over it. We acknowledge that that person had something happen that impacted the rest of their lives. And I don't think there's anything wrong with acknowledging that the same thing can happen on an emotional basis. There are people around here. I'm one of them, carrying around emotional baggage from what happened during childhood. That you as you gain a little bit of insight, you realize you're still dealing with. Because there's never been anything to do except deal with it by yourself. There's never been any therapy. There's never been any real counseling about it. Because it wasn't something you could talk about as a child. And I guarantee you, there was no group counseling for those three children, nor will there be appropriate counseling for the more than 2,000 separated children at the border.
Yeah, and I get that. I really do. And that's why I was hesitant to put it the way that I put it, and I may have even put it wrong. I guess what I'm saying is, could there possibly be another way with dancing with the lingering residue so that it is not as impactful in a negative way as it was for that guy who couldn't hold a job or went through life thinking things were his fault?
Well, the problem, Scott, is that it doesn't operate on a conscious level. It becomes a matter of self-sabotage through unconscious actions. You know, you don't wake up in the morning and say, well, it's another day, I'm not going to be able to hold down a job. It just turns out to be what your normal becomes.
Well, what I'm getting at is, to the extent that someone becomes conscious of the dynamic, certainly there should be some space that's created out of that to maybe look at the possibilities of other ways of dancing with whatever the lingering residue is. That's really all I'm saying.
In the case of her brother, she says he's 80 years old and he's still memoiring it. He's still dialoguing it. He's still journaling it.
Well, see, that to me shows up as being stuck in one story. And we all do that to various extents. It's like those biographies that are supposedly penned by famous people who can't write. And underneath the famous person's name is as told to or as told by Joe Blow, the ghostwriter or the collaborator. To the extent that's humanly possible, I don't want my life to be a case of as told by some other circumstance. And maybe it's just a matter of along the way I've learned how to become a fortunate bastard when it comes to dancing with these things. I won't even say that I deal with things like that. You know, the way that I deal with them is not to deal with them, because dealing with them implies discussing the shape of the table, looking at the issues at hand, and give and take. I'm not going to give or take with a horrible experience in life. I'm going to take it for what it was. If there's any value from it, I'll latch on to that, and to the extent that's possible, move forward. But again, that's not why I called. And
okay.
I'm sorry I brought it up.
No, don't apologize. I mean, that's the purpose of these conversations.
Yeah, well, and it because it's so debilitating to people, and now you've got a whole new crop of little kids who are going to be scarred to some extent or another for the remainder of their lives, it's always a topic worthy of conversation. And we ought to talk about that again sometime. I want to veer off into the matters of filling that new coming vacancy on the Supreme Court. There's another potential trauma that needs dancing with. And we better learn the steps now, because I'm old enough to remember Clement Haynesworth and Carswell, Harold Carswell, the two people that Nixon tried to appoint, who nominated them for seats on the Supreme Court, terribly flawed jurists, if not human beings, and they both went down in flames. And I think we got Rehnquist out of that deal, if I'm remembering my Supreme Court history. And then later on, under Reagan, Robert Bork, do you remember that?
Oh, he was a disaster and a nightmare.
Oh, so I'm hoping that Trump will be stupid enough to nominate someone who is similarly flawed.
Yeah, but I'm gonna take issue there, Scott, because this is not. I mean, he will treat it like a reality show. We saw what he did with the Gorsuch nomination.
Sure.
But he's not making the choice, and make no mistake about it. He's a fool, an idiot, and a schmuck.
Yeah.
But the choice will be made very carefully. By some folks at the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, who damned well know which fork to use with the shrimp and which one to use with the oysters, okay?
Yeah.
And they're not going to pick some raving maniac. They're going to pick someone like Gorsuch, who himself is a disaster, is a judicial disaster, and if you read a couple of his opinions so far. Nuttier than a Christmas fruitcake.
Yeah.
Okay.
Only because
this guy is replacing. You know, Gorsuch replaced Fat Dead Tony.
Yeah.
This guy's replacing Kennedy, and they are not going to run any risk whatsoever that this bastard is going to have any centrism in him whatsoever. And there's nobody out there who's trying to fly under the radar and pretend to be somebody he's not. I mean, remember, Earl Warren was appointed by Dwight Eisenhower. And yeah. Eisenhower thought he was appointing a nice, conservative Supreme Court justice. And then Earl Warren turned out to not be who Eisenhower thought he was. The same thing happened with, what was his name? David Souter. In the Bush administration.
Was it the Bush administration? Yeah.
The first Bush administration.
Yeah, Souter.
And he manifested a little tiny bit of independence of thought and action from time to time. That is not a mistake that they will make. I mean, they're not going to nominate some guy in a clown suit. And frankly, yeah, they're not the people out there who already have reactionary records like your Joyce Rogers Browns. Uh-uh. No, probably not. It'll be somebody most people who aren't inveterate court watchers have never heard of.
And it probably won't be another Harriet Myers deal, which was another.
He's not going to be allowed to nominate a Lulu.
But there is a silver lining here, okay? If I understand you correctly, Trump is working from a list from the Federalist Society?
Yeah, most likely.
Okay. Well, we learned a couple of weeks ago through some source or another that when Trump reads something on a piece of paper, he crumples it up and throws it away.
No, he tears it up.
Because
there's a couple of little White House staffer whose job is to go into the garbage and tape it back together because it's illegal for Trump to even be doing that.
Hopefully that list did not was not caught by the tapers. At 65K per. I think there's two or three of them. Jesus, to be so lucky to have that job.
Yeah, no kidding. But the problem is that Chinless Mitch has said, you know, we're by God going to have a hearing, and he's acting like a guy with a 60-40 majority when he's actually a guy with a 51-49 majority.
Yeah. Well, and see, that leads me to this question about the Supreme Court pick and the Democrats' response to it. Now, we know what was done to, God, I can never remember his name,
Merrick Garland.
Yeah, okay. Mitch just didn't allow the process to unfold according to, you know, robots' rules of order, okay? He just said no. He threw a big old fat happy wrench into it. So what do Democrats do regardless of who Trump nominates? Because we've got to assume that Trump is going to nominate some right-wing reactionary asshat who can pass for sane.
Well, I mean, the guy's not going to, and it'll probably be a guy. Maybe it'll be a woman. But it'll be somebody who will manage to sit at the table and not start, you know, spontaneously masturbating in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee or picking his teeth with his toenail clippings. But that's about as far as it'll go in terms of basic human decency. There's not a hell of a lot that Democrats can do. One, I mean, Chuck Schumer has a hell of a hand dealt to him right now, because thanks to Gorsuch, one of the things that Chinless Mitch did was to finally get rid of any possibility of filibustering a Supreme Court nominee. That's over. It's gone. Okay? It's done.
It's not.
It's gone. The 60-vote majority needed? No. That's why Gorsuch was confirmed 55-45 or something like that. He didn't get 60 votes. That's over. But again, it's a 51-49 majority. And Schumer's job is made particularly difficult. And McConnell knows, you know, he's evil, but he's intelligently evil. So he knows he's got to have the confirmation hearings and the vote before the election, because he damned well may not be majority leader afterward. And he also has to have it before the election because he's got to be able to twist the screw on Claire McCaskill, Joe Donnelly, Heidi Heitkamp, and Joe Manchin. Those are all Democrats.
Right.
And they're all Democrats who the conventional wisdom says are at risk. So that means that 49 that Chuck Schumer was dealing with probably just turned into 45. Because, among other things, I can't speak to Donnelly, McCaskill, or Heidi Heitkamp, but I can tell you that way back when he was just a little pissant legislator, Joe Manchin never missed a chance to go to the fetus fetish bean dinners. West Virginians for life. Okay? So he doesn't give a fuck about a woman's right to choose. And, of course, we've got a female senator in this state now in the form of Shelley Moore Capito, who is, of course, the daughter of the single most corrupt politician that has ever lived in the state of West Virginia, Arch Moore. And she doesn't give a damn about her sister's rights to choose either. So that means that he's got to make, that means Schumer probably has to make up 6 votes. Because he's got to, because Manchin, Donnelly, McCaskill, and Heitkamp will all mugwump.
Well, let's look on the Republican side.
Well, McCain's probably not going to vote.
Up.
Yeah, McCain's not going to vote.
What about Susan Collins?
Well, that's the next thing I was going to say, Scott, is we are now being treated to the Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski carnival sideshow, in which the for-profit media tells us that, well, you know, Susan Collins is certainly not a sure thing. You know, she's one of the last remaining moderate Republicans. When the woman's voting record is nothing but a long series of mumbling some occasional platitudes about what a fucking centrist she is, and then doing exactly as she is goddamn well told to do. Okay? So you got Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski. You got Jeff Flake, and you got Bob Corker. Now, Flake and Corker I place no faith in because, frankly, whatever they think of Trump, they like and they have always liked this conservative constitutional originalism horseshit that the Federalist Society, the snake oil that they and the Heritage Foundation have been peddling for a generation now. And so the only thing that Schumer could actually do is convince his own caucus to stay in line and then pick up two Republican senators who agree to vote with the Democrats and defeat the Senate of having a quorum. And that means the Senate not doing any business at all for the rest of the year. Now I don't know what kind of a betting man you are, but I wouldn't drop a fin on that wager.
Well, no, probably not. But what about working days? They're going to be headed off to their July 4th recess pretty soon, and then isn't there a recess prior to the elections in November?
Well, the August recess is there, and but Mitch has already calculated all of this stuff, and the hearings will be in either September or October, and they will be done quickly, and he's got one more thing that he can get rid of, and if it gets even remotely close, he will, and that is letting the vote go to the floor if by some miracle the Senate Judiciary Committee should happen to refuse to confirm the nominee. Here, we've done this before. This is a game we like to play. Let's look at the makeup of the Senate Judiciary Committee, shall we?
Well, and let's also point out who's missing. The former senator from Minnesota, Al Franken, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, absolutely.
Who would have been a good person to have on our side, Kamala Harris, Heidi Heitkamp, and whoever else.
Oh, yeah, the lady's upstanding Christian brigade. Yeah, right.
Yeah, Gillibrand. And I'm telling you, and I don't mean to veer off, but I will be hard-pressed to vote for any of that gang of however many women it was who totally jumped the gun on Franken, just overreacted to a fare-thee-well. But anyway, go ahead with the judiciary.
Okay, so let's make Senator Chuck. Chuck. I eat off other people's plate. I eat off little girls' plates. Grassley is the chairman of Judiciary. That goes back to a story that Carol Baker told about being a little girl growing up in Iowa and having him reach over and eat off her plate.
I remember that. And by the way, the people out in Radio Land need to be taking notes of these names of these Republicans. And if you're into arts and crafts, this would be the time to make voodoo dolls. simply because it may not help, but who knows? It couldn't hurt.
Okay, so the chairman is Grassley. The ranking member is Dianne Feinstein, and of course we have to spit on the ground at the mention of her name because she's horrible and not anywhere near ideologically pure enough. But the fact of the matter is she didn't waste any time coming out and saying, oop, nope, sorry, we don't need to be considering anybody. She did that. As far as the Republican members, let's automatic yay vote. Grassley, Hatch, Precious Lindsey, John Conan, Mike Lee of Utah, who considers himself a constitutional scholar. Whoop! Oh, look.
Isn't there some talk of Trump nominating him for the court?
Oh, I don't know. It wouldn't matter. He could vote for himself. Then there's Senator Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, the anointed booger-eating future king of America, son of Rafael Eduardo Cruz, the man who forgot to become an American for a long time. And then there's independent, free-thinking conservative Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, who is as reliable a yay vote as any other Republican on there. Jeff Flake, we discussed. Mike Crapo of Idaho. Fahm Tillis of North Carolina, and John Kennedy of Louisiana. John Kennedy exhibited a little bit of independence, but when it comes down to something like this, he will ask Donald Trump to if he will part his cheeks to let him kiss his ass, or does John Kennedy need to part them for him? Then there's our side, the no votes. Feinstein, Leahy, Durbin, White House, Klobuchar. Chris Coons was kind of mushy. Blumenthal was kind of mushy. Mazie Hirono, Cory Booker, and, yes, Kamala Harris. Now, that means you got to pick up at least one, a draw, a tie, according to their rules. A tie results in no recommendation, no confirmation coming out of judiciary. That means you got to get a Republican. And the A Republican is presumptively Jeff Flake. The rest of them, when it comes to a Supreme Court nominee, are going to be nothing but lick spittles. So, let's assume you pick up Flake. Then, McConnell blows up the old rule about nominees not getting out of committee unless they win the vote. And so he blows up that rule and just sends it to the floor. And then the analysis that we've already been through obtains, and you get some fucking maniac on the Supreme Court.
Now, help me understand this. Can he arbitrarily make that rule go away, or is there something that must be voted on?
Nope.
Well, that's just crazy. That's just absolutely absurd.
Well, I mean, even if you have to vote on it, he's still got the votes.
Yeah, I know, but, I mean, give me at least the illusion that there might be a hope in hell of forestalling the inevitable.
Well, illusion's fun when the prestidigitator's pulling the rabbit out of the hat for six-year-olds, but I presume we're all grown-ups here, Scott.
Well, yes, that's true.
I'm sorry.
The Democrats cannot do anything at all to slow walk any of this process?
There's one method, and I told you what it is, and I told you what has to happen in order for that to take place.
In other words, not have a quorum, and then
they got to hold their entire caucus together and get at least two Republicans to caucus with them and shut the damn Senate down until the new Congress is sworn in.
Well, I guess I'm thinking voodoo dolls then. I hate to do it, but...
And see, that's a pain in the ass because any bills relating to funding or, God forbid, funding of the military, and, you know, there's Julius Geezer up on the stumps, and they're trying to... The obstructionist Democrats are trying to starve our hard-fighting troops to death.
So the best we can hope for is a flawed nominee, which may or may not, probably won't be likely, but there's always that chance. I mean, there are no secrets when it comes right down to it. Sooner or later, no matter who you are, stuff will come out.
Well, it will, but it does. But it's not gonna, you know. And that makes, and I guess that's another case of, you know, Bob Kincaid, Little Ray of Sunshine. But I got to get out of here, Scott. I want to make sure and listen to Malloy as he comes back this evening after his illness. I'm rooting for him.
Okay, well, hang in there, Bob, and hang in there, fun lovers and truth seekers, and have a snow cone and kick back if you can, and
or put a swirly straw in the tequila bottle and do it for me. I can't.
Keep on keeping on, I guess.
All right, Scott, you take care.
All right, Bob, see ya.
Later. Somebody, Scott in San Diego. On the way out the door, a couple of notes. Thanks, Clarence, saying I did the right thing with the bicycles. On the other hand, Ron and Raleigh gets a cowbell. Don't tell us how not to illegally ride our bicycles in a restricted area, Bob. James is working on the Golden Gate circa 1984. The sidewalk was shut down on the Marin side. You had to walk down the stairs and cross to the west sidewalk to finish crossing. We saw a cyclist shoulder his bike and look to traffic for the perfect time to transit six lanes of traffic at 50 miles an hour plus, both directions. We tried to get his attention, but he couldn't hear us for the noise. He got lucky. My friend Billy was interviewed about the dangers of his job hoisting roadbed sections 15 by 45 feet. The reporter wasn't looking for the answer he got. Drunk drivers. The job's dangerous enough. Mix the public up into it, and all hell can break loose. As to migrants, Ron tells me, an undocumented person can buy a house. I'm not surprised. I'm just trying to figure out how somebody with no money can get a credit card. Jack in Shreveport, subject line toddler, says, I am right in thinking that a person has to assert their rights in court to get them. Can a judge assert rights for them? What the fuck is the deal? Immigration court, and I never had any contact with it whatsoever, is an entirely different animal than your typical courts. They're administrative, and they got entirely different rules. Bill in Allentown, Bork was the guy who helped with the Saturday Night Massacre. Damn straight, and that's part of what torpedoed his nomination. Let's see if I'm missing anything else. That's pretty much it. All right, thanks, everybody. Thanks to all of you who keep all the plates spinning on all the sticks. Thank you for finishing June's fundraising and qualifying us for the Trash Fitz Walker Stand Challenge, courtesy of Ralph's. Thank you so very much. Thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in this little conversation. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. And thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.